Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. My name is John Manuel. I'm joined by J.J. Cooper. Here in the podcast nook, our new computer, a new podcast computer. We've gone off the Mac train for just for this computer. J.J. is very excited about it.
For the tech geeks out there like me, we're running an Ubuntu box now for our podcast, which I run Ubuntu on my laptop and my desktop at home, so I'm very excited.
Or just putting a little bit more, we put a certain level of effort into the podcast, and then we'd maintain that effort, and that effort's not enough. So now we're putting more effort
into it. Trying to raise our game.
I do remember fondly recording the first podcast at the previous home of JJ's previous church.
Yes.
And being on a wireless mic, I loved because I was walking all around as if I were preaching.
Right.
Which was funny.
I think that was a preview podcast. I don't think that ever made air. Yeah. That's not episode one. That's episode zero.
That's right. It's episode zero. And I believe approximately 10 of the 15 minutes were talked about baseball. And then Will and I went into a long Project Runway discussion.
Which, if you go back to the very early episodes, there was a lot of those kind of a feature that y'all had.
It was, and we're going to lasso Will back into the podcast. We had him on the top 100. It'll be like one of those old Bill Simmons skits they do that went over so well on ESPN, where it was him and his buddies at a diner. I think Will and I would probably record a few over at William's Kitchen sooner or later, but that would also go back to the bad technology of the podcast. But we're going to talk a little bit of just spring training. We're going to talk a little spring training. Minor leaguers in action. The Bapper is back out. Baseball America Prospect Report. We'll take some of your questions, which you've got on the Twitter, on Facebook, or via podcast at baseballamerica.com. You can always feel free to email those into us. And just a review also some of our top 100. JJ wasn't in on that last podcast on the top 100. Who missed and who might be more likely to jump back into next year's top 100?
Right. We covered the top 100 pretty extensively in the hour that y'all did last week. But we wanted to talk today a little bit about,
What's next?
A lot of guys, you know, we had essentially, if you want to put together rankings, I don't think they were ranked exactly like this, but if you wanted to put together a rankings, we had another 100 and we had
about 94 guys. Yeah, 94 guys got votes who didn't make the top 100, 194 vote players who got support on a personal 150.
And by the way, with that made me think also, we've just talked around the office a little bit also. We've gotten some emails where people asked, they said, so where's the dream draft?
Yeah, which is awesome, actually. It kind of ties back into talking about Project Runway or other stuff like that on the podcast. I mean, I think we were like wondering if that was too self-indulgent. But I think people disagreed completely and just really wanted to see different ways of evaluating the same players, basically.
And I said last year when we did a podcast after that, to me it was such a useful exercise just from the standpoint that not that someone can have an opinion, but there were a couple of guys who it became pretty clear, okay, I remember, was it Jay Austin? Did he rank fourth in the Astros? Who was it?
I think that's it. I think Jay Austin ranked pretty high last year.
And then there was
sixth in the
Astros. Then Darryl Jones with the Cardinals were a pair of guys who were ranked very highly on their team's top tens. And they weren't deep systems, but they were on their team's top tens. And round after round, it was something. It was Jones, and it wasn't Austin. It was Jones. But round after round, no one was buying. And it's one of those things where if one person takes a guy high, it's one thing. But if round after round, everyone is aware that a guy's there and no one wants to draft him, that was a very useful exercise from the standpoint of, clearly there's a consensus around this table.
Would have been pretty amazing to watch how quickly the Royals would have flown off the board this year compared to other organizations, for example.
And when you say would have been, you know, we still talked about there is, if we can find the time, there is a chance that we will have some sort of
There's a possibility of the popular demand for dream draft.
And I enjoyed doing it.
Yeah.
It was fun.
It was a lot of fun. And, I mean, it's fun to always also look back. We had a dream draft, 6 years ago on the major league level? Some of those are pretty funny to look at.
Yeah.
Some of those lists are bad. My list, I remember, turned out okay. A lot of my personal cheese balls turned out very good. The Houston Street, Carlos Quentin. But a lot of those... Yeah, a lot of those picks. And also, it's also amazing to go back. I think you, me, and Lingo, and Callis are the only people left on the staff who participated in that major league dream draft in 2005. But like, Brandon Wood was like a second-round pick, so didn't quite work out.
With last year's dream draft, we have everyone still – everyone could draft again this year. Or we talked about it possibly having a supplemental draft to just add to last year's dream draft.
No, that's a possibility. We could just – Yeah, you get the guys who graduated to the big leagues are out, and then you have a whole new character. Well, they just graduated your big league team. Right. You're just drafting a farm system is what
right.
we were
You're
doing
drafting
last year.
A farm system, right.
But yeah, but I liked what we did this year. I even forgot that I didn't even include one of my risk factors. Which one did I leave out that I wanted to do that you were the one that you liked?
Aaron Hicks.
That's right, Aaron Hicks repeating low A. I don't even know why I left that one out. So I covered risk factors, a personal cheese ball of mine. I like risk factors. We went ahead and did split decisions. But I think the popular preference was, wow, Dream Draft was awesome. So we still might get to Dream Draft later on this year. But it's kind of like a Dream Draft every day, JJ, with spring training games right now.
It's
just such a benefit.
And with MLB Network, let's
and that's
just
it.
Say.
Let's, all the credit goes to MLB Network. 3-4 years ago, it was just so rare to see prospects on TV. And now, thanks to MLB Network, you get prospects every day on TV in spring training. And I'm even working with the Durham Bulls right now on a schedule for which MLB Network games. There'll be, 11 MLB Network games of minor the MLB Network will show 11 minor league games this year. Three of them will involve the Durham Bulls. So three of the 11 games scheduled. So one of them is on the day of the draft.
I'm going to bet the Gwinnett Braves are involved at least in another one.
I haven't even looked to see who they're playing.
Because one of the things is that works into this is if you have a quality television production.
Well, three of them are in Durham. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Three of those 11 broadcasts originate from
quality,
Durham. Right.
If you have a quality television production, your chances go way up because
right.
there's just it's a little tough to find those.
That's right. It is. And when you're owned by a TV station, it helps. And the Bulls going up to 6 cameras from 4 this year, which will be interesting. And one of them will be a mobile camera. So I'm excited about that. And one of them will be on draft day, JJ, June 6th, a noon game, and then the draft is a primetime game. So we're going to have you're going to have more Baseball America staffers on TV on MLB than you want. With me and then expecting Jim Callis to be part of that draft broadcast again. So, but I think the nerdy moment of the spring for us in an office where a lot of nerdy stuff happens. But the nerdy moment of the spring was you and I. First, the email came out, cookies in the break room. So let's set that up.
Cookie.
First, cookies in the break room. Then second,
I didn't even know. But the funny thing is, I'd just gone for water. I didn't even know there were cookies in the break room until
I
showed up.
Well, that's why I was there. I was there. I came for the cookies. I stayed for John Gaston and Daniel Brewer, which was the funny part. I mean, we both kind of geeked out on seeing Astros and Yankees. Guys,
great.
And you've been geeking out all spring on any Royals game possible on MLB Network. I mean, just how much has it changed for you? It's just like it's changed my viewing habits. And this time of year, I'm usually locked in 100% on college basketball, but I can't be not with all the baseball on.
That was easy for me because I'm never as locked in on college basketball. So for me, it was something where the great thing is, it sounds funny, but tape delaying these games for some of these games
is
great. I mean, I'm DVRing them a lot too, but
right.
I'll be listening to some on the MLB. I'll put another free plug in. The At Bat app is a wonderful thing because I'm listening to games while working and all that. Hey, for my job, listening to games is part
that's
of
right,
my
it's work. You just write it off.
Yeah. But, and then knowing, that, okay, well, I can see a couple nights, I can see John Lamb throw an inning, things like that. And
Danny Duffy.
Not that I haven't seen those guys pitch at some point, but it's also, it's fun, it's fun to see, okay, does he look the same as what I remember? Does
right.
he look a little different? And again, I'm not a scout watching him, but at the same time, it is, okay, so is he pitching the same, is he using the same approach that he did? I mean, it's an inning in spring.
Right.
You don't put too much.
You take it for what it's worth, but it's still much better than not seeing, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the great thing about it is that these first couple of weeks of spring is the point where you see prospect after prospect after prospect.
Yeah.
When we get later in spring, you're not going to see that as often, as much, because what you're going to see is that, okay, we're down to working out, figuring out who's going to be the 25th man on the roster,
right,
who's going to be
right.
the fifth starter, that kind of thing. But right now, I know there were a couple of days ago, there was a Red split squad game, and doing the Reds list, seeing Juan Duran and Ronald Torres.
Yeah, that was amazing.
And players, Ryan Lamar, I think, got in, Kyle Waldrop. I mean, these guys weren't even pros.
Those are all 2010 draft guys, the
right.
last two guys you just talked about. And Torres, didn't Torres play much of last year in the VSL or DSL?
Yeah, the VSL. Yeah.
That's amazing. That's really amazing. And then the next spring he's in a big league game. The other part of this, one thing that sticks out to me on this, JJ, is, for us, we're both nearing 40. So we're dating ourselves a little bit.
Yeah.
But like, I lived in South Florida for a couple of years and would go to West Palm Beach Expos and Braves spring training games. And only a couple because I was in school most of the time.
Right.
But I did go to a couple games. And the Mets moved to Port St. Lucie right around that time. So that was the big shiny new one. You used to think Florida spring training and the Cactus, like, yeah, there are a few teams that go out there. Now it almost seems like Arizona just dominates spring training. I mean, it seems like most of the games are from Arizona as well. And you can really see – you just see a difference in just spring training just has taken up such a notch from several notches from where it was when we were younger.
What's interesting is that from a team standpoint, Arizona makes a whole lot of sense.
Right.
Because there are no bad trips in Arizona.
Right. Yeah, they're bad road trips.
There are no bad road trips. They're pretty much the games are all clustered together. Now, the downside of that is I've seen some of these games on TV where pretty sparse crowds there at times. But it does mean, you know, for the teams, okay, it's going to be 45 minutes on a bus maybe. Or in many cases, you're playing the team that you share the complex
right, exactly.
with. So it's something where you just walk out of your clubhouse and you're playing another team was essentially playing a home game for them too.
Your worst case scenario in Phoenix area, in Arizona, because everything's around Phoenix now. No one's even in Tucson anymore.
Right.
But your worst case scenario is bad traffic, which does happen out there
right.
quite a bit.
But you're still talking about bad traffic in probably an hour and a half, whereas if you're going east to west in Florida – You're talking, and that doesn't happen very often, but when it does, that's a much more significant trip.
I'm almost surprised that no one charters flights in Florida, to be honest with you. I mean, Miami to Tampa, you may as well fly. It's just not, small
state. But the reality of
there's no one even left in Fort Lauderdale now, the Orioles have left.
I was going to say, but the other reality of that is that on that trip, That's the game where they, you know, there's that minimum
that's the
rule.
B team, yeah.
I was gonna say there's that minimum rule of how many major leaguers you send.
Yeah, exactly.
You are cutting it as close to that list as you can. Like that's the game that Ronald Torres gets into.
That's right. Well, yeah. Two BA staffers are going to spring training later on in March, and I know Connor Glassy's trip is already pretty much booked up. And you know, it's a BA trip, so he's gonna do a college story. He's gonna do a junior college story. He's gonna go see Francisco Lindor. He's gonna go see the guys at West Boca High. But he's also going to spend part of that trip at spring training. But when you are in South Florida spring training, there's not that many teams left down there anymore. On the east coast of Florida, you basically have the Marlins and Cardinals sharing at Jupiter. You have the Mets at St. Lucie. Then up the coast in Vieira, you have the Nats. And even the Nats are squawking about getting out of Vieira.
And then you're talking about, if you go from there, then you're talking about moving halfway across the state to the middle where you've got, you know, the Braves
right.
and the
Astros
and the Tigers.
Right.
And then you're talking about going all the way to the
– That's it. Then you're on the West Coast. The Gulf Coast of Florida seems like it's still pretty strong with spring training baseball. Whereas the East Coast, I mean, I don't know if it's because of the Marlins. It's not exactly like the Marlins have a rabid fan base that precludes anyone from coming down there. But I think it really started – when the Yankees used to be in Fort Lauderdale, but when they moved to Tampa, that was a magnet, I think, for South Florida spring training, and now that magnet has followed the Yankees to the West Coast in Tampa. So we have a couple of questions on the Twitter and Facebook. We'll take a couple of those, and then we'll obviously keep on talking a little bit, get back to the guys who got top 100 votes but didn't make the top 100. The Skeester, who I'm going to read this on Twitter, read this question, even though his Twitter icon is a Duke logo, much to my chagrin. Do you think Brett Lowry sticks at second base for Toronto? What's his ETA or ceiling? Brett Lowry made the top 100. I guess I could look up exactly where, but I don't exactly remember where he made it. But he's divisive, though, JJ. We have a lot of second baseman on that top 100. We didn't include Brett Lowry in the split decisions top 100.
Because
but
there's a whole lot more question about whether he's going to be a second baseman
than
some of
the others. I mean, like, I think he ranks as high as he ranks because we believe in the bat, and he's young.
And some athleticism. And the athleticism.
There is athleticism there, but more than we believe him at second base. I think if he wanted to play second base, he could play second base. I think if it mattered to him is what I should say.
I think that's the knock that you hear is that why Brett Lowry may end up as an outfielder down the road or something is the question of it being, okay, you know, we heard you've talked to notice scouts and that have said, well, I think he could have stuck at catcher if that was something that he really wanted to do, but the hitting seemed more important.
Yeah, yeah. I think the tools were there for him to catch. There's no doubt about that. But there's more to catching than tools. And It is hard.
Especially if you are a plus potential impact bat,
right,
who doesn't drink into the, you know, the greatness of catching.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Then
the virtue almost,
yes,
of catching.
Yeah. And all the pain and all the extra work that goes with it.
Because
the reality of it is that the catcher is the hardest working guy on the team.
Oh yeah. No, there's no doubt.
You know,
and if you throw in that, if you're a switch hitting catcher, which we'll get to that in a second in one of our other questions, if you're a switch hitting catcher, you have to work twice as hard offensively as well as defensively than most players on the team. But yeah, Tim, the thing that was most concerning to me about Lowry was talking to scouts who'd seen him last year, who thought that his arm strength was down from what they'd seen previously. And that's, again, that's just, you just work on it. A lot of professional players lose arm strength from being amateurs to professionals because of the grind, and not everyone necessarily throws every day or keeps long tossing every day. Long tosses for position players too. Just ask Steve Springer, Quality of Bats, I believe is his website, but he also is a scout for the Blue Jays and a quality control coach. And one of the things, Steve Springer won like 5 best tools awards in his playing career at BA, and was always for best infield arm. And it was almost always a AAA. When he was a AAA veteran, he'd still win best infield arm. I mean, he was a long toss guy. And it sounds like Brett Lowry has not maintained his arm as a pro. And he's not the only one. I'm not singling him out.
Right, because you hear that a lot. Like, you hear a lot of guys who say, well, it's a 50 arm now. Usually, with most, you know, like if you're talking about a high school guy and you say, well, he's 40 power now and it projects to 60.
Yeah.
He's, you know, his hit tool, obviously, it's a 30 hit tool now, but you know what? It could be above average down
those
the road.
Those tools are supposed to get better.
Right. But you'll hear what the scouts say. It's his arm, you know, this outfielder. Well, he's a 45 now, and if he doesn't really stay on it, he could end up being a 35.
Yeah,
know.
And speed and arm go backwards the older you get for a lot of players. It doesn't have to, but you have to work on it. And so the thing is, for Brett Lowry, he's getting, even though he's athletic and even though he had plus arm strength as an amateur, you're talking about a guy who's starting to make himself into more of a left fielder down the line than a right fielder down the line. I don't think, though, the Blue Jays intend to let that keep happening, because they gave up big value for Brett Lowry.
Right.
They gave up a good pitcher in Sean Markham. Exactly.
They clearly believe in him, and that's why they traded for him.
And I just happened to see Alex Anthopoulos at the winter meetings the day that trade went down. You know, he had lunch with another front office executive, and he was in the same restaurant where Jim Callis and I were having lunch. And we talked
name
for
Robert.
A little while. You know, I will completely name drop. And he said he agonized over that trade. But bottom line, they believe in the bat, and they do believe in the athleticism, the two key points that you made. So that's, we're not just pulling out of thin air. That's exactly why they were making that deal. We have another question on our Facebook feed from Cleo Stamatos, who happens to be my sister. But it's a legitimate question. Orioles catcher Matt Wieters, is he going to have a good year? You know, is this the year he lives up to his potential? Cleo's interested because she's my sister, but also because she lives in Towson, and she used to live down the street from she lived on Charles Street down the street. We could see Camden Yards from her apartment. It was literally, Matt Wieters wasn't there yet, but JJ,
I would say hi in Greek to Cleo if I could.
Yasu. It's pretty easy, but yeah, but I mean, like, here's that's right. That's a legit question to me about the future of. About prospecting. You know, just this week is in the news, Baseball Prospectus wrote about failed prospects, and they had Matt Wieters as a failed prospect. Do you consider him a failed prospect yet? Do you consider him a disappointing prospect? And what do you think he'll do going forward?
He has to qualify as a disappointing prospect just because of the expectations that were put on him. Like, if you pull out the prospect handbook from, I guess it would have been 2008?
2009, actually.
2009.
2009. 2008 he was our minor league player of the year.
But so you pull out the 2009 prospect handbook, and if you look at that, well, he projected as an above-average hitter. He projected to have above-average power.
Right.
He projected to be potentially at least above-average defensively.
Yeah.
I mean, it was across the board. Up to now, he has not produced as an above-average hitter.
No, absolutely not.
He has not produced at above-average power.
Definitely not.
I think the defense is actually probably the thing that's been the most, I think the Orioles feel relatively happy about how
I haven't seen a ton of complaints. I mean, I actually, it's interesting because in North Carolina, if you don't have DirecTV, you can't watch the Orioles. There's this giant dispute about Orioles and Nationals TV rights and Masson and all that stuff that's not worth going into here. But we both have DirecTV, so we both watch Orioles and Nationals games. And, you know, my layman's eye, I think that Matt Wieters' catch is fine. I think that he will make a pretty significant jump offensively. I do think it actually is going to probably come this year. I think that his first year, it's just hard to – you're just overwhelmed as a catcher. I think between hype, catching, and the drudgery that was the Orioles, I think Matt Wieters has been weighed down by that for a year and a half. Last year was his first full major league season, and I think that's the drudgery of the Orioles got to him. I expect that team to be better this year, and I expect him to be significantly better because I think Buck Showalter's not going to accept just being okay. I think that actually matters. Expectations are higher. I think that matters for a player like Matt Wieters.
But I also do think, it's definitely too early to make any kind of judgments. You can say he's a disappointing prospect, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, but I think a lot more was expected out of the 89.
You can't say let's write him off yet because his first, really, year and three quarters has not been to expectations.
He's 24 years old. He won't be 25 till September. Matt Eddy and I were just talking about a story idea, and, Matt the first thing Matt thought of when he was talking about Matt Wieters, he started comparing him to Jason Veritek instantly. And Veritek wasn't even a big league regular until he was 27. I think Wieters has a chance to have
one of those years was a
Northern League year.
Yeah, I was going to say one of those years. His arrival is delayed a little bit because of long.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And it's an easy comparison to think of because both switch hitters, both catchers, both Georgia Tech alumni.
And both considered. I mean, when Veritek was coming out,
His offensive numbers at Georgia Tech were better than Wieters.
Right.
He never had a minor league year like Wieters had in 2008.
Right, but this is not something where if you think of Jason Veritek now and go, well, but Veritek's never the hitter. No, Veritek was considered the hitter that Wieters was.
If you're going to have a college catcher of the year award, it should be the Jason Veritek award. He's the best college catcher ever. That's just what it is. But, to me, I expect Wieters to have a better offensive career than Jason Veritek, but it wouldn't shock me if he just settled into a Jason Veritek-type career, where I think he has more power than Jason Veritek. But I think that, as a catcher, I just think it makes what Joe Mauer does and, to a lesser extent, but not too much lesser, Brian McCann, what those guys do even more remarkable, that you can catch 120 games a year and produce offensively at such a high level like that.
But you also hit on a key thing there that works into it. It's funny, but with a catcher, the expectation is if you can do it for 120 games a year.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the grind of the position is so much that
121 games behind the plate last year as a starter for Matt Wieters. So, I mean, he's right at what I expect. To me, a regular catcher should start 120 games, and a backup should start 40 games.
This is also a good reminder of when you have a catcher who's a plus offensive, like we're talking about Brett Lowry, the possibility of him being a catcher.
Right.
If you believe in the bat and the catching is projects his average at best,
right,
I know it's easy to say, well, but, the value of having that guy as a catcher. There is some value also of having that guy in the lineup 155 games a year.
Right, absolutely. No, that's a great point. I mean, we're talking about this obviously a lot with Jesus Montero. I mean, he's the number three on our top 100 list. And now there's talk in Yankees camp, speaking of spring training, of Francisco Cervelli having an injury. He might be unavailable. The chances are higher right now for Jesus Montero to start the year in the big leagues than they were a week ago. I happen to think that Montero, early career, I don't think he can catch. I don't think he's good enough defensively to catch 120 games a year.
But if you
I don't
said,
think the Yankees
but if you
think
said
that.
50.
Right. I've definitely thought 50 is in the realm of possibility for a long time. And now it appears that the Yankees actually start to think that maybe 50 to 100. And the reviews on him this spring are more positive.
Again,
and he's trimmed up.
Not,
it's clear that he's
not,
trimmed up.
Not a scout. A scout disclaimer at the start. But having watched a couple, you get a lot of Yankees games on MLB Network right now. Because Yes Network, hey, if I'm Yes Network, I'm airing every spring training game.
You're rather airing Yankees spring training game than Nets games.
Right. So that being said, Montero has looked trim. And his work back there behind the plate, one of the key things about catching is want to.
No doubt.
And he seems, I mean, again, watching games on TV, he seems engaged in the game, and his receiving has actually been okay. One of the things that's always going to come back down to with him is how important is controlling the running game.
Right.
Because,
right.
And it's funny, it's really with him, it seems like as much a footwork,
it's a flexibility, footwork, and technique issue than more than it is an arm strength issue. He's got average to plus arm strength.
Right.
And so he'll get you some 1.9 or 2.0 pop times.
You'll get 1.9, 2.0.
And you'll get 2.2. 2.3.
2.3. And 2.3 is, you know.
2.3 is Matt Stairs might be stealing that base.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm overdoing it a little bit there.
CC Sabathia, you know, if he was in Milwaukee still, is sighing and going, hey, I'm timing this out. I might be.
That's part of it, though. You also have CC going to the plate. He's not exactly quick to the plate. You've got A.J. Burnett, whose concentration will waver. I think the biggest thing to me is I think that Montero will be a better – he'll receive better than Jorge Posada, because Jorge Posada is one of the worst receivers. I've been talking to several scouts about this last year. I mean, he's one of the worst receivers in the major leagues year in and year out. He didn't used to be. But when you get in your mid to late 30s, you're just not as good as a catcher as he used to be. I'm not harsh on Jorge Posada. It's just the reality.
And receiving quality big league stuff is a very difficult task. There's a lot of catchers in the minors who the big question becomes, okay, can he handle 95-mile-an-hour heat and nasty slider?
That's why Buster Posey was lower on our preseason rookie list last year than he should have been, obviously. I mean, he was 20, I guess. We didn't see clear opportunity for him, and all the reports were, well, maybe this guy's not going to handle top-quality pitching. He's going to handle the best pitching in San Francisco, and he made a huge stride. So I expect you're going to see a lot more Montero this year behind the plate. That we maybe have been led to believe.
I'll say this. If Cervelli's hurt and Russ Martin is your option one.
Yeah.
Even if Martin's healthy, you can't say, well, okay, you know, we're going to Jason Kendall him like the Royals did last year where he's going to be out there for 20 of the first 21 games. You're not doing
but
that.
But it'll be fascinating to see Montero. He is catching a lot, how his offense suffers. Because I think he's actually more of a pure hitter than Matt Wieters. Which is saying something, because I think Matt Wieters, again, his double-A season was about as good a year as you're going to see in the minor league. So, obviously I'm biased, but great question by Cleo. And we have Michael Barr on our Facebook page also asks, speaking of rookies, are the Phillies rushing Dominic Brown? I think Ben Francisco should be the everyday guy in right field. JJ, I just read a column today by Bill Conlon, who's been covering the game for a long time, has eaten more about baseball than we have than we remember. That's just an easy fat joke made by a fat guy. But I've emailed with Bill Conlon, and he knows the game. He actually bankrolls a youth team and helps coach it in his spare time. But he just wrote today about how mechanical Dominic Brown looks and how Dominic Brown has clearly lost the plate. He's searching. He went 2-for-29 in the Dominican. He seems to have lost the momentum that he had last year in the first half, that call to the big leagues and that spare time in the big leagues where he didn't play regularly. Really seems to have affected him, and it sounds like he's not going to be the everyday right fielder in Philadelphia, JJ. And watching him in spring training, I only saw one at bat. It was not a good at bat.
I saw a couple, and they were not particularly good either. One of the knocks against Brown coming up through the minors was, okay, this guy, just remember, this guy's a little rawer than some of the other guys that you're.
That's why he's not Jason Hayward.
Right.
Or even Mike Stanton.
Right.
He's even a little bit more raw than Mike Stanton.
The approach is not as advanced. It's not. Well, we mentioned Stanton. I hate to say I can't compare anyone's tools almost to Stanton because
he's not as physical as Stanton.
No, just, well,
no one is.
Bryce Harper is.
That's about it.
Josh
Hamilton.
Yes. And then we're done. Okay.
That's the level of physicality we're talking about.
Right. But take that out of it. But his approach, like Jason Hayward, we talked about it last year, at this time last year when Jason Hayward was, you know, just having quality at bat after quality at bat. And one of the things about Hayward that made him stand out was his approach was so advanced.
Mm-hmm.
He recognizes pitches well. He works himself into counts. And then he would drive the ball. Well, Brown, one of the concerns is that earlier in his career was, okay, the approach is not as advanced yet. And if you combine that with if he is really thinking about it, if his swing is becoming more mechanical, then you've got really a bad situation because you're talking about a guy who is not and has not really yet in his career been as comfortable working counts into hitters' counts.
Yeah, not like Hayward. Very few people do like Hayward. He's always had pretty good, you know, walk numbers throughout his career. The surprising thing right now to me is that it sounds like Brown's swing has gotten longer and loopier. And it's always, he's 6'6". It's always had some length to it. But that's a pretty big concern. That's an adjustment he's going to have to make, and it's harder to make that adjustment when there's pressure on you to win a job.
Right. And with that, with the longer levers, it's something that we've heard scouts say before. Okay, there's more maintenance involved.
Right.
If you're a long lever guy, there's more maintenance.
Absolutely.
In maintaining your swing. Now, at the same time, how do you maintain a swing? Well, the guys who are really good athletes have an easier time usually maintaining a swing than a guy who's less of an athlete.
Dominic Brown's
an athlete.
It's different for Dom Brown than it is for Brennan Bosch. Brennan Bosch, a big guy, long lever guy with the Tigers, got off to a great start last year. Once pitchers found his hole, he did not have the athleticism really to make that adjustment.
Going Tigers, but when you say that, another guy I think of is Ryan Strebe.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And he's the right. He's the whole, that goes back to risk factor, he's the whole right first baseman stiff guy. And if you did not believe in Ryan Strebe, he's that. And the other thing is, if you believe in that right conundrum, you don't believe in Matt Laporta. You don't believe in Chris Carter.
And there
are a lot of scouts who don't. So,
And let's go into that a little bit. Because, like, I had some questions about when I was doing Reds about Dave Sapelt. And it's like, well, why is Sapelt not rated higher? And the funny thing about
it is, he is divisive.
But it's not just right first baseman. Like, with Sapelt, there was kind of that question of, well, you know what, if he batted lefty,
right? I think you'd
be an entirely different player.
I think you can get away with being a left-handed hitting guy with 50 tools everywhere. If you're a right-handed hitting guy, it's harder because you're just going to see same side pitchers all the time, and he just doesn't have a carrying tool,
right? So let's go into explain to someone who's going, okay, so what exactly is the right conundrum?
Well, I mean, I think the main thing what I've gotten from scouts over the years is that if you're a right-handed hitter and you're not terribly athletic, you're going to see so many breaking stuff and you're going to have that hard time getting fastballs in. You're going to have the athleticism to make those adjustments constantly, and a lot of hitters don't have that athletic ability. It takes spectacular hand-eye and hitting tools, hitting ability to be a right-handed throwing guy. And most of those guys are middle infielders, can be right because they're athletic enough. But if you're right, the right-handed hitters in the big leagues who have that right profile are either great athletes, like a Derek Lee, or Jermaine Dye was a guy who comes to mind who was like that, or guys who moved off other positions that are just unbelievable hitters. Paul Konerko, Albert Pujols leap to mind.
Well,
just constantly having to adjust to right-handed pitchers throwing your break and stuff. That's just not easy to do.
And another factor in this is roster makeup, is that, okay, if you are that elite, that Albert Paul Konerko, the guy who's the cornerstone guy in the lineup, well, that doesn't really matter. I mean, but if you're not, if you are borderline guy, well, your middle infielders are generally, I mean, there's some switch hitters or some, but you obviously got to throw right-handed.
If
you're going to play second, short, or third.
Right.
So a lot
Scott Rowland, another great right guy.
A lot more of those guys are going to be right-handed hitters.
Hanley Ramirez.
So you usually want to have several lefties in the lineup. And again, when you also talk about platoon differential, if you're a guy, well, again, that's the whole thing. If you're a backup outfielder,
you can count the left-handed hitting middle infielders, by the way, like on two hands in the major leagues, especially shortstops. That's why I've talked about on the podcast before, Reed Brignac. A lot of scouts like Reed Brignac being a left-handed hitting shortstop. Steven Drew, left-handed hitting shortstop. Those guys really stick out to scouts because there's not that many of them.
And that's why you see also speedy guys, one of the reasons they want them to switch hit.
That's right. But Sapelt, I don't know that the right thing – I think that the thing is, from a fourth outfielder standpoint, is where it hurts him. And actually, we're just talking about Ben Francisco. That's a best-case scenario career in my mind for Dave Sapelt. I think one of the biggest issues for Dom Brown, besides his own struggles, is that I think he may have come to camp and realized Ben Francisco is a better fit for that team. Right now,
yeah,
I think he
is.
They aren't right-handed enough. They only have the regulars in their lineup who are right-handed hitters in Philadelphia are Placido Polanco and Carlos Ruiz. So Ben Francisco is a really solid player. He just makes sense for their lineup
and
in right field.
Especially because they do not need – Ben Francisco will be – Gold Glove caliber.
Yeah, he'll be good in right field. He's a very good right fielder. And Dave Sapelt is not as big as Francisco. I think Francisco's 6'1". Sapelt's 5'9". I think the thing is with Sapelt is it's hard to project him to hit for average power at the big league level.
And I'll say this, he might.
He's not a burner.
He's been a guy who's proved, he has to prove guys wrong all the way around. all the way up the ladder.
I think he's like a 45s and 50s everywhere on all his tools with maybe a 55, 60 run, and the hit tools are really – so he just doesn't have a – he doesn't have a true 60 tool, does he? Maybe speed, or is it maybe the bat?
Maybe the bat.
So if he's a 60 hit, I think he will be a Ben Francisco, or maybe even a little bit better version of that, because he could be an everyday fringe average center fielder defensively and hit enough to be out there. But
the thing that's going to be tough is that, again, what we talk about is that, okay, so then it really becomes, if you're a regular, it doesn't matter.
Right.
But if you're a platoon guy.
Yeah. You want that lefty
you
bat.
You want that lefty bat as the platoon guy, you know. And going for him is that he can play a couple of positions out there in the outfield, which you also want your backups and to ideally be the guy who can also swing over to center.
And I think it can be overdone the other way. And one of my all-time personal cheese balls, one of the reasons I overdid him was because he's a left-handed hitter, and that's Jason Prydy. I always thought Prydy, because of his speed, his defense, and left-handed bat, would get enough time in the big leagues to figure it out, and he didn't because he's just too aggressive. Never toned down his strikeout-to-walk ratio, and timing was never right for him either. But, I mean, I loved that guy as a player. And
yes, you did.
I mean, I was all about just Jason Prydy. And basically what I thought Jason Prydy would be is what happened with Denard Span. So, sometimes you miss, that's one of the times I missed.
Again, a good reminder also as far as tools, because Span was a guy who really almost through much of his minor league career, if you wanted to see negatives, you could find negatives in his game.
Absolutely. There were a lot of them. His development has continued even at the big league level.
But right, if you keep knocking negatives off of your scouting report, that does a lot for you.
Absolutely. JJ, let's wrap up the podcast and talk a little bit about this Jim Callis and SBA, where he talked about everyone else who got votes on our top 150 and for our top 100. And maybe pull out, speaking of personal cheese balls, some of our own personal cheese balls. Now, Jim just presented them in alphabetical order. One thing that's easy to search through here, though, is guys who got votes on all six ballots. All six of us who voted included these players in our top 150s. Angel Beltre of the Rangers is one. Aaron Crow is one. We've talked a little bit about Aaron Crow. Raymond Fuentes, traded from the Red Sox to the Padres. Yasmani Grandal, Matt Harvey, both of whom did not miss the top 100 by much. Same thing with Aaron Crow. I think it's fair for us to say those guys were in that 101 to 120 discussion.
Right.
All three of those guys were close. Francisco Peguero of the Giants, I don't know that he was as high as the other guys, but he definitely got voted on all six. Yorman Rodriguez of the Reds did. Jerry Sands of the Dodgers. Zach Stewart, who I kind of feel like we've chronically underranked. And I'm as at fault for that as anybody, and I think you're probably has always been his biggest defender.
I was gonna say I'm a Zach Stewart fan.
Yeah,
I mean, I can understand a little bit of why he's underranked, because he's always been that guy who's bounced back and forth, rotation bullpen,
right.
Rotation bullpen, and he has been traded. So you put the two together, and
he's never like been just left alone. Doesn't have one big minor league season that would get your attention, whether it's his role or his.
But he
team.
also is a guy who. Probably the best way to describe it is I feel like he's a relatively safe bet to do something.
Oh, yeah, no, I agree. And he had a pretty nice year. He had a pretty nice year in Double A last year.
One as good as the year before was blew
you
away.
The year before was a better year. Yeah, his strikeout rate dropped and his walk rate was higher.
But
I still think of him as more of a relief pitcher who could start.
Right, and I think that's a fair – I think he's going to get the opportunity to prove he's not a starter.
Yeah.
I mean, to prove he is a starter.
Right. And the thing is, to prove he is a starter. And the Blue Jays' track record for the last decade is pretty good on taking guys who are relievers and making them starters. Sean Markham is the latest example. Dave Bush before that.
They did
it with Casey Jansen before he went back to the bullpen.
There are people in the game who believe that college relievers are a really good bet, because you get guys who've pitched in pressure situations, because
mm-hmm.
when you're talking about college relievers, what you're really talking about is college closers.
Right.
But if you have a college closer with some secondary stuff, who's not just a fastball or just a fastball split or something, if you got a guy who has a changeup, really.
Absolutely, that's it.
If you have
Sean
a changeup,
Markham. Yeah.
But if you have a changeup, well, then we can make you into a starter, and the advantage we get is you're probably going to be a little lower in the draft than you would be because –
Right.
Teams
not as exposed. Yep.
You're not as exposed. And also, not a whole lot of wear and tear on that arm, because you probably, what ended up happening is you were pitching probably three, two to three times a week
right.
for an inning to two at a time. So,
yeah, Markham started as a freshman at Missouri, then transferred to what is now Missouri State at the time, Southwest Missouri State, you know, through 76 innings those last 2 years. So he was not
much wear and tear on the arm. And the other thing with that is, but at the same time, because of the probably pitching as well at some point on Tuesday or Wednesday of the week, it's even maybe a little less adjustment to going from the 7 day schedule to the five.
Yeah, actually, not a bad idea. Not a bad point. I had not thought about it from that.
Because you know, to explain a little further, I'm sure y'all probably follow that. But you, as a college starter, you essentially are on a once a week schedule.
And you throw once a week, and then you throw a bullpen in between.
And a couple of teams will say that they'll use you for an inning.
That's right. If you're Jeremy Sowers, back in the day, you had to pitch on Tuesdays also to close out games. That doesn't happen to too many guys anymore, but it still does happen, absolutely. And Jordan Wall was another guy who got six votes. That doesn't have to be from this pool of players, JJ, but who on this list was kind of your personal cheese ball? I'm sure there's more than one, but...
You just mentioned Walden. I think that Walden is going to be a solid pitcher for the Angels at the big league level this year. I think that if I'm a fantasy player,
yeah.
I wouldn't mind having him on my roster as a dollar guy or something like that, because depending on how
like
your league is, he may be more than a dollar. But 98, 99, 100 with the movement.
And that's a coaching staff and a manager, Mike Butcher with your pitching coach, but then obviously Mike Socha knows how to develop a bullpen.
Right.
There are a lot of that was obviously the key to their 2002 World Series championship, and that's been a big key to their sustained success in Los Angeles. I think both of us think the Angels are going to fall somewhat this year with their $50 million worth of center fielders who don't play center field. There's some issues on that team. They did not exactly have a great offseason.
$50 million of center fielders don't play center field. Oh, yeah, by the way, coming up before too long,
the best center fielder. That's right.
Baseball.
No, absolutely. It's crazy. I'm counting Gary Matthews Jr. in that list of center fielders who don't play center field. He doesn't happen to play baseball for anybody anymore, to my knowledge.
So,
but I agree. I think Walden's a good guy to pick up there. And he came close to – I don't remember if he made our top 20 rookies or not, but that'll be discussed on next week's podcast.
I was making a pitch for him. I remember that.
We had a lot of relief pitchers in that mix is the thing.
It is tough. It is tough. Like, especially when you say, okay, compare him to, say, like a Craig Kimbrell who
– Right, right.
Who they're saying right now, hey, that guy –
He's already done it.
That guy's going to get some saves this year.
I'm not even sure that it's one of these – it doesn't have to be one of these six guys. Are there other guys?
One other guy I wanted to mention just because I think that – well, I'll give two. Two guys from my Reds top 10. Yoermin Rodriguez, Yasmani Grandal. Both of those guys, if you told me that they're on next year's top 100, I'd actually probably be less surprised to hear that they're on the top 100 than to say that they're not next
right.
year.
Right, yeah, that's
Grandal,
fair.
Grandal, just give him a full season, if he does what we expect him to do, he'll be a top 100 guy next year because of the attrition of guys above him moving on and moving off.
Right, right.
Whereas Rodriguez, this could be a breakthrough year for him. If he's not on the top 100 next year, that's a pretty bad sign because tools-wise, he's got excellent tools.
He has top 100 tools, and he made progress last year. It seems like he's on this upward trend where he should be on there next year.
And we're still talking – and we're talking about a teenager, breaking into his first full season in full-season ball this year. So that – just put it together, and if he has a solid season at all, considering his tools, considering his age – considering his pedigree, I would expect to see him in the top 100 next year.
Yeah, no, those are good picks. I like both those picks.
What about for you?
You know, I think I even had him on my top 100 this year, but I kind of like Chris Owings, and shortstop infielder in the Diamondbacks organization. Mm-hmm. And the more I looked at him, there's not a huge difference between him and Nick Franklin, not in terms of their tools, not in terms of – and Nick Franklin has a little bit more patient approach right now. That's the difference. That's a big reason why his power – played more, and he was also healthier in the Midwest League than Chris Owings. But I think this is going to be a breakout year for Chris Owings. And if you liked Chris Owings when he was in high school coming out of South Carolina, he got a lot of Gordon Beckham comparisons. And I could see it, and I've talked to a lot of scouts about that, both when he was an amateur and just this offseason, just emailed with a couple guys about that. And he has some positive buzz for me. I think Chris Owings is going to be a guy who's going to jump up this year. And I also think he's pretty crucial for the Diamondbacks organization, one that really just – I'm not excited about a lot of their prospects.
The the interesting thing is that the numbers they had in, you know, and again, Owings only played 66 games.
Right.
Franklin played, but the numbers are not as different.
Yeah.
As they, as you, at first glance, they look at, you look at their slugging percentages and, you know, Franklin had a better year. There's no doubt.
Yeah. Oh, no doubt.
But Owings had the doubles. Owings had, the number that's impressive, Owings had 19 doubles in 62 games.
Right. Right.
You know, Franklin had 22 doubles in pretty much a full season.
He drove the ball consistently. Right. And it's a middle infielder who's a legit middle infielder who in his first pro season was driving the ball consistently.
Right. That is that's a very good guy to keep an eye on for 2011.
For me, that's one of them. I also think Max Stassi. I like Max Stassi. I like them a lot. And he's kind of the same kind of thing we're talking about with Weeders and we were talking about with catchers earlier in their career. You know, Max Stassi comes from a baseball family, baseball pedigree that we've written about a lot. I think the swing is a good swing. I'm probably biased because I saw him at the Under Armour deal in 2008 up in Wrigley Field. I think that guy's going to hit. He showed me more power in his pro debut than I thought you'd see. And I think he's going to be I've talked to the A's about this. And they thought we undersold him as a defender in high school with his reputation as a high school catcher. For me, Max Stassi's – I know I picked two Midwest League guys that are Jim Callis guys. But I actually think Owings and Stassi are going to be – I expect them to have to consolidate their gains they made last year and to put them on fuller display and put up some big numbers in the Cal League this year.
It will be interesting to see because there's that kind of that whole group of catchers, those young high school catchers who you have to be a little more patient with them.
Yeah.
And it's a little easy to kind of forget about those guys somewhat.
And to me, Max Stassi's an easy guy to believe in. I love the makeup, and I really think that he's a guy who he has the defensive tools. He's going to be a big league catcher. I think he's going to be a better version of Kurt Suzuki. So maybe that's telling you what his ceiling is. I think he's going to be a better version of that. A guy who's a league average or better offensive player and is a league average or better defender as well. And I think people know, maybe not as much as Will Kimmy used to, but I love Kurt Suzuki. So.
And the thing about it is if you have a league average defender, league average hitter.
You're almost an all-star.
At catcher.
You're
not
a winning
looking
team.
To replace you.
You're a winning team as well. And that goes back to the David Sapelt thing. I feel like David Sapelt is good enough to be a big leaguer, but I feel like he's the guy that you're always looking to replace if he's your everyday center fielder.
Whereas if you've got a league average catcher, you're not looking to.
You're looking to lock that guy up long term.
Right. That's the thing is that it's easy to forget because of the. And it's really. Look, it's a great time for catchers. I remember.
It is. I
remember many years ago now, but. It's funny as it came out at the time, but I think it was Sporting News. It may have been Baseball America. I think it was Sporting News, though. But back when I was in college or getting ready to head to college, and there was a big feature on where have all the catchers gone, and it was, this whole point about how these young whippersnappers they don't want to
get back there
and all
don't want to get dirty
right. At the time, it was, Todd Zeal moving off of catcher and that kind
nice.
Of thing.
Todd Zeal reference.
Nice, but now we are in a great, great time of catchers. I mean, it may be true that in a couple of years we can't say that if you got league average defense and league average offense because of the
right.
massive number.
That's like a good point.
I mean, McCann, Maurer, Carlos Santana.
McCann and Maurer are looking like, Hall of Fame. Guys, I think Brian McCann doesn't get enough attention for that. I mean, that guy's just a stud. I know he's not the defender that Maurer is, but he's a huge reason why the Braves. Yeah, exactly. He's a huge reason why the Braves are still the Braves, even with all the changes they've made. I mean, I love Brian McCann, not as much as our tech guy Brent Lewis does here at Baseball America. But we're talking about maybe it was a good place to wrap this up because we're talking about veteran catchers. Jorge Posada, Hall of Famer for you or not?
Okay, let me ask. I'll answer that question two different ways.
Okay.
Do I think he's going to make the Hall of Fame? Yes.
Do you really? Okay.
I think that there is an aura that comes from
the Yankees.
As much as the Yankees playing on championship teams.
Right. Right.
Playing on championship teams carries weight with voters, I think.
I think his 123 ops plus is what's going to carry the most weight, but I think he's going to fall just short. I think his counting numbers are not quite there. Maybe 20 years from now, 15 years from now, the voters
also,
will.
We don't know where his counting numbers are going to end. Is it going to end now, or is he have a couple more years where he's going to? I don't. It's hard for me to see, to
Good
be
question.
Honest with you, the Yankees going with Jorge Posada as their DH for long, for a significant period of time, just from the standpoint of they're the Yankees. They could put any whoever they want there.
Well, this is I believe his last year under contract is this season. His contract expires at the end of 2011, so he's DHing this year. It might be his last year there. We'll see. But I mean, he's 261 career home runs. Most of those, obviously, as a catcher. But you're looking at over 162 game average, thanks to BREF. Talking about a guy who's been a 275, 377, 479 guy for his career with 25 homers a year, basically. That's pretty outstanding. I think his defense is what's going to, in the end, will work against him. He's a pretty bad receiver, but, and he has been for a long time.
I guess my question becomes, 5 years from his retirement?
What people are going to remember is, oh, A.J. Burnett didn't want to throw to him. Oh, David Cohn didn't want to throw to him. Those beat writers who were around New York are going to remember that, oh, Mike Mussina didn't want to throw to him. And those things are going to stick out.
He's the longer-lived Javi Lopez of the 21st century.
He's a better version of Javi Lopez, but yeah. And, I mean, whereas a Mike Piazza, you know, you wanted to run against Mike Piazza,
but
pitchers never begged out of – that's right. And Al Leiter was talking about the other day, and obviously they were teammates and they're buddies. But, you know, people did not beg out of throwing to Mike Piazza. And he caught, you know, on great teams. So did Posada, but I think it's a little bit different with Posada. I don't think it was just that, oh, I wanted to throw to Girardi. You know, even after Girardi was gone – Yankees pitchers didn't always want to throw to him. They'd rather throw to Jose Molina sometimes.
I mean,
whoever the backup
that
was.
same analogy, but that was the Javi Lopez thing. Whereas
that's right, Eddie Perez. Absolutely,
Greg Maddux did not want to throw to Javi Lopez.
So I think that eventually will end up working against Posada. Although his name was perfect for John Sterling, John Sterling has his pluses and his minuses. His pluses is hearing him say Posada, but I definitely, for me, he's a little short of a Hall of Fame. But I think that. Brian McCann and Joe Mauer are also short right now, you know, but their careers are trending toward Hall of Fame. And like you said, maybe a league average catcher won't be enough down the line to be an all-star with the catchers that we've had. But great questions that we had on the podcast, and I think it's kind of funny that we both picked catchers, Grandal and Stassi, to jump on next year's top 100.
I think we're thinking catchers.
I think so, too. Well, we're going to wrap up the podcast here for Baseball America. We'll be back with next week's podcast, and don't forget Monday, Aaron Fitt and I with the College Podcast. So for JJ Cooper, I'm John Manuel. Thanks for joining us on the Baseball America Podcast. So long, everybody.